Hey everybody, welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Hope you're having a great week, start of your week. Hope you had a good weekend as well. I have my kids. My wife went to her 20-year college reunion in North Carolina, and so I was on my own for Thursday through Sunday. Luckily, the house was not burnt down. Everyone got to their things. We had a nice time. So even got to take the kids to the driving range on Saturday, which was awesome. My son, I think he's starting to get it. We're working on some things in terms of takeaway, and we don't hit balls very often. Like I got into golf when I was 12, so I don't feel like there's any hurry to be into golf, especially because he's got good hand-eye coordination and he does other sports, so I think those things will transfer eventually, and it seems like they're starting to. He's starting to kind of understand the takeaway and getting your weight through. He was hitting his little four hybrid, his kid's hybrid, like 125 yards. I was pretty impressed, gotta be honest with you. I'm sure the kids hit it longer at his age. I'm not worried about that. We can clean all that up, but I think he's starting to click. He might start liking the game, and that's got me really excited. I have to be honest. My dad, he played baseball growing up. Oh, by the way, I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thanks for being here with us. You can catch us on your favorite social media services at Golf News Net, and I'm the handle Ryan Ballingy. So, when I got in the game, my dad, he came from the world of baseball and softball, and the reason I picked up golf was because my uncle played and my godfather played, and they played in like their own golf league on the weekends, and this was pre-internet days, like sophisticated internet days, where you just had spreadsheets and photocopies of tee sheets and points and all this. It was a really cool league. I think it was called the Rebels. I don't remember what it was their league was called. I have to ask my Uncle Russell. His birthday was yesterday. Shout out to Uncle Russell. 72. Still one of the coolest guys I know. And my dad didn't really play golf, you know, growing up. He just played sometimes with me because he knew I was into it. And he came from baseball and softball, and that did not translate very well to golf. And so when we would go to the driving range, he could offer some things as tips, because I think some things translate between baseball and softball and golf, but not tons. And yet, he still has a tremendous interest in when I play and asks me how I play, and when I play golf, and, you know, asks me how I'm doing and if I'm playing well and all that stuff. And it's different than the relationship I would probably have with my son and the game of golf, because I'm probably going to try to teach him a fair amount and then get him started. And then if he shows interest, have someone who's a qualified teacher do the hard part, do the part, the refinements, do those types of things. I mean, I started out with four lessons with a driving range pro, and I had two lessons with another guy when I was in 9th or 10th grade, because I wanted to see if I could get better. Hated the guy. I've never had a lesson since. No one's ever worked on my game in a formal setting other than that. I've learned things from all kinds of different people in terms of just observing, watching shots being hit and asking questions, but never sat on a range like, all right, for an hour, we're going to work on this skill or, you know, this thing or this piece of the swing. I've kind of done it myself. And I think there's a lot of value in that. I think there's a lot of value in knowing what you do right and what you do wrong, and then being able to compensate for those things. Like I know in my takeaway is way too long. I go way past parallel. I'm more like John Daly in that regard, but I've grown accustomed to that over 30 years. So it doesn't bother me. The timing thing doesn't matter. And I know that over the years, I've had a history of taking the club too far inside. So I've worked a lot on that the last couple of years, of picking my takeaway path to set up the kind of shot I want to hit. And that's been really important. But when I get to the top of my swing, I know I tend to be closed down the line. And so that leaves me a propensity to hook the ball sometimes, come over the top and hook it. And I've worked really hard on trying to kind of control that better and know what that means for how I deliver the club. And it makes it hard for me sometimes to hit a cut for that reason. I know that. Those are the kinds of things I've learned the little band-aids I've learned to get myself through a round, those things all matter. And I think a lot of that comes from having ownership of your swing and having ownership over your golf knowledge, not just relying on what someone tells you to do, kind of taking it, embracing it, figuring it out for yourself, figuring out how best you can use it. So I want to build that in my son if he cares about golf enough to pursue it any more than just hitting balls with me. If you want to improve as a golfer, you gotta have kind of have to learn where you're starting from and where you're going and what your limitations are before you then go delve into a world where you can go a lot of different ways and get better. I thought there was a really good point made. I don't remember where it was. I always forget where I see these types of instructional things. But it was a look at two very different professional golf swings. I want to say like Victor Hovland was one, and maybe Will Zalatoris or the other, but they were opposite. One was very laid off and one was across the line very, very, very much. And both are world-class players. You don't have to be perfect and you don't have to be the same to be really good at golf. You just need to have a lot of good common core things that you do right in terms of how you deliver the club, in terms of making sure you kind of have a good shoulder turn, good extension, good transition, all those types of things. But they don't have to be exactly the same. And so for him, I hope if he gets into it, and I'm not going to push him, not going to deny it. If he wants to go hit balls, we'll go keep hitting balls. If he says, I want to keep hitting balls. And if we go every darn day and I go, okay, well, maybe we should talk to somebody about getting you to a better place if you want to play competitively, then we go there. But I want him to know before he ever gets to a lesson tee what kind of works and why it kind of works. Because it took me a long time to figure that out. And I think I could have been a lot better of a competitive golfer, a lot more willing of a competitive golfer if I knew the why. And I think so many teachers don't do a good job of explaining the why. They just explain what to do. And that I don't think is on purpose. I think they're just trying to get the message to people. But it prohibits their ability, I think, to really absorb what happens in the golf swing for them and what they can do to make it better or to band-aid it when it's not working. So that all said, I'm so happy I got to take him and my daughter hit clubs on the U.S. Kids Golf Yard Club on the range for the first time. And at the end, I asked her if she liked it because she didn't really want to go, but it was just me and the kids. So she kind of had to go. I can't leave her home by herself. And she loved it. She wanted to go back for more. And I'm so excited about that because that means she enjoyed it. And if she wants to give it a try, then it went well. And maybe we can someday, when I'm a little bit grayer than I am now, hit balls on the range or go play 18 together or 9 together and just have fun as a family. As I'm looking at this photo that's in my office from the first time that we played together, June 8th of 2020. When we played for the first time during the pandemic, it was something we could do. And I hope there are many more photos like that someday. So a little bit about that. But we have a really good show for you today. We're going to talk about a couple of things, kind of shorter segments today. So we'll do 4 segments of the show. And then the last segment of the show will be about a 20-minute conversation with my friend, good friend, Josh Jacobs, who is the founder and CEO of College Golf Experience. Talking about the world of college camps, and that somewhat ties into my experience playing high school golf and also trying to kind of get my kids into the game, but not necessarily knowing all the answers about how to get them involved and politely, but, you know, encourage them to become players, but not force it on them, because I don't want to be that kind of parent. I don't want to be a kind of person to force something on my children. In terms of a hobby, right? Like excellence, I want to teach you that, and I'm going to do my best to instill that in you. But a hobby, I just want you to be happy and healthy. So how do you kind of pursue that? And this conversation with Josh is a bit of an extension of that in terms of, all right, well, if you took it from that starting point and you got them all the way into high school golf and they have internalized and want to be collegiate golfers, how do you take that next step? And Josh is the expert of experts in that front. So we talk with him about college golf camps, what they mean, what you can get out of them, and how his company, College Golf Experience, helps foster that kind of opportunity. So we'll go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little about LIV Golf's team championship event, what that might mean for the tour, where they go from here, and then we'll get into a couple of other things here, including an opportunity for more DP World Tour players and more PGA Tour players to be in the same fields next year. We'll be back right after this. If you're like me, you've wanted to buy gold for years. Lots of commercials out there, but who can you really trust? I don't want a bad investment, but didn't want to miss the boat either. Sound familiar? Fortunately, I've got great news. If you have an IRA or 401k and want to buy physical gold, eliminate fear and uncertainty from the process using the new Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist. It helps you evaluate and choose the best gold IRA company. I used it personally to vet Augusta Precious Metals, and they are absolutely phenomenal. Use this checklist to choose the best gold IRA company. Text to get your free Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist today. Text GOLF to 68592. Again, text GOLF to 68592. That's GOLF to 68592. Or go to AugustaPreciousMetals.com. All right, welcome back, everybody. Good to have you here this week on the 19th Hole Golf Show. I am Ryan Ballingy. We are going to talk a little bit about LIV in this segment. And I want to talk about their team championship, which happened just this past weekend down at Trump Doral in Miami. It's not Miami. It's Doral, which is like a half hour from Miami. I don't know why they call it Miami. Well, I know why, but it's not Miami. It's not even close. So they had the team championship event wrapped up on Sunday. Not a lot of people there, to be honest. On Friday and Saturday, there weren't really anybody there. Sunday, at least, it was a little bit better, but in terms of attendance for them. But it doesn't seem a whole lot of people are compelled by the product. Still, the team format works. I didn't like it. I don't like the stroke play component, but the team match play part really works. And the stroke play thing did do okay because it wasn't a total blowout. It was kind of close that they had four team flights basically, and the best four teams from the match play, the ones that won through, they got into this top flight for a chance to win. Then you had a second flight of four. The losers on Saturday, and then the losers on Friday were in the bottom flight. And it was all stroke play. Every player score counted to a total for the team. Lowest team total won. Bryson DeChambeau's team won. They won by, I want to say, 3 strokes, but they wound up winning. And, you know, Bryson's very excited, and so are the other guys. They each earned, I think, $1.4 million. And then the team, quote unquote, got 60% of the purse. So the players didn't get that. Went to the franchise to use how they see fit. So kind of a subsidy for this team concept. And having now seen 22, I mean, I haven't watched them all, but there have been 22 LIV Golf events. They've had a season and a full season and an invitational series, which really was a season. So they've had 2 seasons of LIV Golf, which is frankly mind-blowing that has happened. But they've had 2 seasons of it, and they still haven't figured it out. They still haven't figured out that what they've got that's different and unique and might be the only thing that can keep them relevant is the team golf thing. Because they play 13 events this year that were individual, right? There were 54-hole tournaments, shotgun start. Yeah, there were technically teams involved. There was a $5 million purse for the team component, $3 million to the team, and then I forget what the other split was, $1.5 million and half million or something like that for second and third. But it was individual. It was an individual tournament because the individual winner got $4 million and the second place finisher got $2 million. So those two places combined were worth more than any of the teams got in aggregate. And that isn't working. People don't care. They don't like that it's shotgun start. They don't like that it's 54 holes. They don't like the funding source. They don't like the team names that really aren't integrated into it. They don't like some of the broadcast stuff. There's a lot of things that you could dislike about that product. A lot of things. What they have that might work is this team thing. And they don't embrace it. Play these events with just the team component bolted on, and it doesn't really matter. And it's confusing because you have 2 events at the same time. And really what they should be doing is playing 10, 12 team events and have a couple of individual events. That's what they should do. And the reason they should do that is because twofold. One, it's an easy subsidy to the value of these team things. They keep they've talked about this week. Bubba Watson talked about, this, oh, I've had, 10, 15, 20 people talk to me about wanting to buy a piece of the team. Never mind who those people are or how much money they have or how serious they are. We won't talk about that. You got Dustin Johnson saying, well, there's a valuation. He doesn't know. Phil Mickelson talking about valuation, all those things. They don't know. You've got Phil Mickelson saying, oh, well, we're talking all kinds of players, PGA Tour players, DP World Tour players who want to play in this league next year. Greg Norman saying the same thing. They said the same thing last year, and they got four guys that didn't move the needle. No offense to Thomas Peters or Brendan Steele or Honor Bond Lahiri or Charles Hyder III or whoever it was. I forget who all the guys were. But no offense to those guys. Danny Lee, sorry. Honor Bond Lahiri was last year. That didn't change things. If you looked at the ratings for the last two mileposts that I was able to find. So the Nielsen ratings for the Saudi Arabia event, which was on tape delay on Sunday, was 93,000 people. 93,000 people. The audience for a SpongeBob SquarePants rerun on Nickelodeon's like a million. Okay, let's just to put that in context. And then for the Bedminster event, I saw this on Sports Media Watch. Their final number was like 185,000, I want to say. Something like that. Pretty close to that. Maybe 186, if I'm off by a digit. But not, sub 200,000. And that was live. And that's in the United States. So, there's not an audience for this. Not a substantial audience. I mean, even not very good fall series events that everyone knows don't mean anything draw better than that on cable with a bad viewing experience than LIV Golf. So the business evidence is clear that there's not something really, you don't have something people are looking forward to watching. And if you don't have something people are looking forward to watching, why would anyone in their right mind invest in that concept in any fashion? Sponsorship, team ownership, whatever. Why would they care? So if you embrace the team thing, you say, okay, we're going to have 10 or 12 of these team events, and the rest are individual events. They could be, quarter season, half season, full season, and they could be special things. They could be, $30 million events or whatever. Whatever they do, I don't care. But if you did that, and you did the team events, you say, okay, every week a team, I'm making stuff up here on the fly. 8 of the 12 teams get money based on how they finish. We're going to play this format. If you get it eliminated on Friday, whatever that elimination is, you get no money. Or, a $10,000 stipend or something. Make it super cutthroat, because everyone getting $120,000 at a minimum is not appealing to anybody. Shout out to the PGA Tour. Paying everybody in a no-cut event is not appealing to everybody. It is a turnoff. So if you say, okay, we're going to do a team format, same every week. Besides, you're not getting world ranking points, so it doesn't matter. You don't need the individual thing anymore anyway. So you go and say, we're going to have the team thing. We have a $25 million purse, half the $50 million one. So all the money's in half. 10% of what your team gets goes to each individual player. The 60% goes to the team, like they've been doing with this team event. And you subsidize the value of the teams that way because you give them cash. You're just subsidizing. Here, congratulations, great week. Here, we'll pump up your value a bit. Keep this cash there so when someone invests, they get the cash, dollar for dollar. That's what you do. That's how you subsidize it. Otherwise, no, it's your differentiator. That's the thing that makes you different. Where you go, okay, this team thing's kind of interesting. It can be compelling if you do it the right way. And you could have variations of the team events. Wouldn't have to play the same one every week. You could have all stroke play. You could have match play and stroke play. You could have all match play. You could have 4-count 3, 4-count 4, 4-count 2. Take the college golf model and work with that. Then that actually helps you from an investment standpoint, helps you from a distinction standpoint. And frankly, it helps you cover up your bad players. Because you got a lot of players in this league, in this tour, whatever you want to call it, league, tour, concept, that are not good. There are maybe 10 to 12 players who can win. And that goes through the 22 events, the 20 individual events. It's like 12 players who have won. So And most of those are one-offs. So if you have about 10 to 12 players who can win, the others are no good. They're not valuable to the bottom line as individuals. They're just people to beat who are spreading around the same money reserved for the bottom half of the field in $20,000 increments. Now, as a team concept, all of a sudden, your dud players are actually meaningful because depending on the format that you choose, they count. And if they count, there's natural drama. Oh, what's that dead weight player going to do? All this drama about Brooks Koepka basically publicly bullying Matthew Wolff. While I think that is terrible, if you did it in a kind of normal way where you had just natural teammate drama instead of some kind of weird targeted bullying, you could go and say, all right, that's kind of interesting. The worst player on the team did something for once. I mean, it feels like the only thing people talked about last year from Liv's team championship was that Pat Perez was not terrible in the final round. He was good enough to mean something. And that was the difference between winning and losing. When you have a lower quality talent is the overwhelming majority of your tour, then you take the good talent, you promote them because they're the cream of the crop. You want to see how they're going to do. But you really want to know how the bad players are going to do. You turn them from a liability into less of a liability, if not borderline strength. This isn't hard to do. And if the Saudis weren't involved and someone else with an unlimited amount of money was doing this, this is easy advice, and I can almost kind of root for it. Obviously, because of the funding source, I'm not doing that. But just take all of this in isolation and go, all right, this is what LIV Golf is. This is when it works, and this is when it doesn't. And you've had 22 events, 20 don't work, 2 do. Well, I'll take it back. One event worked really well, and that was a 2. The one was at Chicago last year, and the one in Adelaide, Australia this year. Everything else didn't work other than these 2 team things and those 2 individual events. So next year they've decided, we're still working on a schedule. We're going to have 8 events overseas and 6 in the United States. They have quickly realized very few people in this country give a crap about LIV Golf. So as a business, and we're really having this discussion because I care about business, not so much because I care about the golf. That means you've got to rely on the international side of things to draw any kind of value. Problem is, you have to mean something either in the UK or the United States to really derive a whole lot of value from your sport. Maybe Australia, but not as much, particularly at least as it relates to golf. So if you can't make it work here, you got to make it work in one of those 2 other big things. I maybe Asia, but I don't see that pathway yet. So what they're going to come up with next year, if they're going to have 8 events overseas, those are 8 tape-delayed events on the CW. Who exactly wants to air that? Does the CW? Because there's a Sports Business Journal report, I believe, out today about, I don't remember who did it, so I don't want to give bad credit, but I think Josh did it. But anyway, the report basically said, well, you know, LIV says they're going to shop out the Friday rights because they're not live. They're on either the app, the CW app, or YouTube for $3 a day, or their website, or whatever. No one's watching that anyhow. So they're going to try and find someone to take those rights. Well, if they're going to be 6 or 8 hours off, at least, because they're overseas, then I'm not interested if I'm an American broadcaster. That's going to be a no for me. So how are you going to do that? Like the decisions that they talk about making fly in the face of what they want to do. And that has been their biggest problem. Second biggest problem behind the funding source is that they don't know what they want and they don't know how to achieve it. It's very clear they don't know how to get what they want. And the end result is a product that doesn't really match the supposed ethos. And when that happens, people get lost and you lose them. So you kind of blown your shot here because you had 2 years of this, but maybe in year 3, they get it right. And the only way they're going to get it right is if they lean into very heavily exactly what we've talked about here with Team Golf. We'll go ahead and take a break. We'll come back. We're going to talk a little bit about some news from the DP World Tour and as it relates to PGA Tour membership for next year. We'll be back right after this. All right. So Let's talk for a few minutes about this, then we'll get to Josh Jacobs in our interview this week. So there's some news that came out today from the DP World Tour. They have announced a new membership category for next year and is extended membership to players who finish 126th through 200th in the FedEx Cup or FedEx Fall standing. So at the end of the fall, the players who don't finish in the top 125, they will be offered from 126 to 200 DP World Tour membership. They could take that up. They could play DP World Tour events in a category that any five players who take up that membership in that category will be able to enter week to week. It could be the same five, but only five. So they're not infiltrating the tour. And the idea behind this is to create kind of a loop, a carrot loop upgrade, downgrade system between the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour. Because DP World Tour is now offering PGA Tour status, not great status, but status to the top 10 finishers in the Race to Dubai if they don't already have a PGA Tour card. And so they're offering a loop back program this way through the PGA Tour. Go, hey, you didn't get your card. You're going to be in that maybe 126 to 150 finishing group. You're going to get some starts, but 150 and beyond, you're not going to get a whole lot of action. So you might get a handful of starts. Well, you want somewhere to play for decent money. Well, now you can do that. You don't necessarily have to play the Korn Ferry Tour for $1 million event. You can go play the DP World Tour for anywhere from $2 to $5 million an event. And you're going to like that a whole lot more. And then that'll help that tour. It'll bump up their fields, even just a little bit with a handful of players who are recognizable to American fans. And that gives those players an opportunity that if they play well, maybe they get in the top 10 of the Race to Dubai. Maybe they play well enough to get into their playoff system and earn some good money. If they get in that top 10, they're right back on the PGA Tour. And it gives them opportunities to play when they don't get in these PGA Tour fields, because we have a very different PGA Tour coming in 2024. Traditionally, players who finish in that 126 to 150 group, the players who just miss a full card, they get anywhere from like 18 to 20 starts. Like, they get a lot of starts. I don't know how much that's going to happen with this new tour, because you're going to have so many events that are already cornered off. They're signature events, they're majors, they're, you know, those tournaments, the big ones. They are half the schedule. The other half of the schedule, well, you have 48 events. Well, seven of them are the fall. So there's 27 events gone. Now you've got 17, 18 events left to deal with. And of those, you're going to get a lot of better players in those fields that might often skip weeks because they want to get into the next signature event. So all of a sudden, a lot of those spots that were available for 151st and worse are gone. They're not available, or they don't mean as much. So this is a good thing. And there are going to be people, they're already out there on the internet going, oh, well, the DP World Tour is a sellout. It's more of a feeder tour. Well, guess what? The DP World Tour has been a feeder of the PGA Tour for 25 years. They had one shot at this, which was when they got involved with the Emiratis, took their money, created the Race to Dubai, and then the Emiratis, borderline sovereign default around the Great Recession, and that's the end. Ever since then, it's been what it's been. And this way creates a very obvious carrot and stick system. We know the PGA Tour is number one. Guess what? They've got like three tiers in and of itself. The top players are getting all the events. The next players are getting all the regular events and all the challengers. Then you feed in the DP World Tour. You've got them close. They're a little bit better than the challengers at their top tier, which is some the European-born best PGA Tour players. Then you've got the kind of regulars, the denizens of the tour that are good. Then you've got the medium. And then you've got the guys that are kind of just coming off the Challenge Tour, heading back to the Challenge Tour. Then you've got another tier of players. You've got players who are coming from what will be PGA Tour Americas. Above that, you've got the players from the Korn Ferry Tour. Then you've got, and they're probably on some level very similar to players in the DP World Tour in a couple of ranges. Then below that, you've kind of got the Japanese Tour and the Korean PGA Tour and the Challenger PGA Tour of Australasia, the Sunshine Tour. You've got a system. It feeds up. It's very defined. That's a good thing. Golf needs that. You need to have a promotion, a genuine promotion and relegation system that creates support for players when they get relegated, not to just be kicked to the curb. This is what we're doing with this. So it makes a whole lot of sense. I think it's a good idea. We'll see how much more it's implemented and taken advantage of once we get to the end of these fall events. We've got a few more of them, three more to go. So we'll find out at the end of that. We've got next week, the Worldwide Technology Championship in Mexico. You've got the Bermuda Open after that, Bermuda Championship after that. And then you've got the RSM Classic, and we end the fall. So we'll see how many players the deadline December to take up this membership. So he takes it up. I think it's a worthwhile offer. It's interesting. All right, we're going to go ahead and take a break. We'll be back right after this. All right, one final segment this week here on the show. My friend Josh Jacobs is going to be the interview this week. Josh and I spoke last week. Josh is the CEO and founder of College Golf Experience. It's a really interesting concept that's taken on and taken off very quickly in the college golf ranks. And it's the idea of offering opportunities to meet college coaches and college coaches to meet up-and-coming players, maybe potential collegiate players, at these camps. Camps of different sizes, different places, different skill levels. And it's an opportunity for a player and their parent or their guardian to meet a coach, maybe a coach they desire, maybe the one they don't even know about yet. Experience programs get on-site at-camp instruction, simulated college rounds of practices, good information, good FaceTime. And that all kind of comes together in a way that hasn't been really truly done in collegiate golf, even though it's been done in pretty much every other sport of significance where there's a collegiate presence. And CGX is really making that happen. It's been embraced very much by the college coaches as a way to kind of add on to the experience of the recruiting process, above and beyond just showing up at college tournaments, above and beyond showing tapes and communications around NCAA-approved deadlines. So I want to talk about all that with Josh, get an idea of what that world looks like, where they are now, because they're about to run some top 100 camps that are really interesting, fascinating experiences over the next couple of months. And I wanted to share this interview with Josh, with you. So in case you are a parent or a guardian or a grandparent or something like that to a child that is thinking about playing collegiate golf, whether early on in the process or even kind of late in the process, this information's for you. So enjoy this conversation with Josh Jacobs. We are joined by College Golf Experience founder and CEO Josh Jacobs, who's here with us to talk about College Golf Experience and the exciting top 100 series of camps that they have coming up here toward the end of the year. So Josh, first, thanks for being with us. And for folks who don't know what College Golf Experience is, give them the kind of 30,000 foot approach of what this is and how you came up with it and how it's working to help future collegiate golfers.
So I've been in junior golf for more than two decades now, and originally had a company that got to a million kids in the very introductory and recreational level. So we were running after school programs in schools, churches, temples, community centers, and we were running recreational camps, and it became this business model that went around the country. And by the time it ended, we had, 4,000 locations, and that came to an end in 2021 for me, where I exited, and this College Golf Experience came to light. And what it was back then was an opportunity to do a platform for college coaches who wanted to run their camps. And when I started doing the research with the help of the Golf Coaches Association of America, what I found is kind of three different things. Number one is players and their parents do not know a lot about college golf, and certainly not about the recruiting process. So parents are, did not have the education, don't have the knowledge in order to be the heroes to their kids and help guide them down to their goal and their dream of playing college golf. Second thing that we found out is every sport has this. If you look at the other sports, they have showcase camps, ID camps, position camps, and golf, the world of junior golf really never had that platform to, number one, showcase college golf and the college coaches, but also to bring together college coaches with players and parents and provide an opportunity for everyone to come together and share that education, that knowledge, help players find their fit. And then the third thing is in the world of junior golf, as I kind of mentioned, there really is not a lot of opportunities for players and coaches to come together. There's just not. When you look at the pathway to college golf, almost all of it is merit-based and all through rankings, points, and tournaments. And there really can't be any interaction between the college coaches and players at junior golf tournaments. So these camps bring together all parties for players and parents to help be led down a path to finding the right fit, finding their program, finding their spot in college golf, along with getting the information and the resources that they need to go down that path and become not only better players, but also to playing and fulfilling their dream of playing college golf.
For many years, we've had conversations about the concept of a player pathway, of getting players into the game at a younger age and then kind of getting them through a progression as they learn the game and then they get maybe to a high school level. And at a certain point, they figure out they want to pursue college golf, whether that's at a top 10, top 100 program, whether that's at a D2 level, D3 level, NAIA level, whatever that is. But it feels like, as you mentioned, and I felt like I went through this 20 years ago, that there was a huge black box in trying to figure out what you were supposed to do and how you were supposed to do it. And there wasn't really a resource to help you. And now you've got that not only in the form of the internet, but you could take that another step farther with CGX and get right in front of college coaches to get good information and see them play, see them seeing you play, get instruction from them, get a feel for their culture. Why did that not exist previously?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, if you think about it, when we were looking at playing college golf, you had the Ping College Golf Guide. You had the Ping Golf Guide. And
Yeah.
that was just a list of schools and you know, approximately what the scores were and gave some information about the programs. And that was really about it, other than really the AJGA. And this is back in the day, right? But now when you look at tournament golf, it's evolved in so many ways. There's so many great regional tours, let alone, you know, AJGA. And so there has been, I would say, in the last 10 years, really much more of an opportunity for players to showcase themselves, but there still hasn't been that opportunity for players and coaches to come together and for players to understand about that, you know, for to be cliche, to understand that college golf experience and what they're going to get, and in turn have these coaches be able to get looks at players and be able to bestow knowledge upon them in a setting where they can interact. So why did it never happen before? I think, you know, it's just an evolution of the industry where, you know, I think we're almost saturated with the number of tournaments out there, the number of junior tours. And so this is just another complementary pathway and a complementary opportunity for players and parents to take as these, you know, as these junior golfers progress down to that next step in college golf.
As you mentioned, I mean, the interaction between potential collegiate players and college coaches is kind of from a distance at these tournaments where they could see someone play, a potential prospect play, but the interaction really ends there. It's kind of one way, and there's not a whole lot happening otherwise. Can you explain to people the value, not only for the player, but also the coach, of being able to talk to one another, experience the coach and how they view their program, and what that means to the player so much more than just, are you capable enough of shooting golf scores to play on their team?
Yeah, as most coaches say, right? There's only so much you can learn hiding behind trees at junior golf tournaments, so you don't get, you know, hammered by the parents and when they see your logo walking around. So there's only so much you can learn, but in a camp setting, there's so much that happens, right? Whether they're educational seminars led by these college coaches on college golf, on the recruiting process, on course management and strategy. They're really getting that college golf experience of simulated college practice sessions and what those entail and how you get put under pressure situations. And then you go into the on-course experience with coaches where they're literally walking through shots with these players and they're getting an understand of how their mind thinks. Listen, coaches know, you know, these players are great. You know, any player that's looking to play in college golf, let alone the highest level D1 all the way down to NAIA or JUCO, they're really good players. And so what these coaches are looking for is a mentality in some cases. You know, as it's often been said to me, we want to know who we want in our van for that 6 hour drive to a tournament. We want to know that our personalities match. We want to know that we're going to get along, that I'm going to get along with your parents. I want to see how you handle and how you react to bad shots when I can walk you through things. So there's so much that goes into these camps that they would not otherwise get. And one of the big things I think that's underrated in our camps is the course management and strategy lessons and interactions that they get. Coaches say that the weakest part of a junior golfer's game is course management and strategy. They can hit the ball a freaking mile, but they really don't have a great sense of how to play a golf course. So when you're able to experience 18 holes with various college coaches and get walked through, there are lessons that you're going to take with you for every tournament that you play in the future. These players, they all have their own swing coaches, but most of the time they're not spending a ton of that instruction on the golf course. And that's really what college coaches do, aside from helping to build student athletes. They're there for them on the golf course. So I think it's a really unique opportunity.
I think there's a key component to all this that maybe some people forget, and maybe some people don't forget that are a part of this process, that ultimately you're a student athlete when you get involved in the NCAA level of competition. And there's an academic component to this. So you've got to be able to be a successful college student. You've got to balance your time between your classes, your friends, your other responsibilities, and your golf team. How much of that is integrated into these camp experiences? And how much is it an eye-opener for some of these players who may have blinders on just thinking about becoming a collegiate golfer?
Yeah, so I'd say that's pretty much the biggest difference that you see in junior golf and college golf, right? I mean, if you think about it, in junior golf, your parents are doing a lot to help you. They're there to wake you up in the morning. They're there to drive you to practice or drive you to a tournament, and you're flying to a tournament. And in college golf, you're on your own. I mean, you really have the autonomy. You've got to have that discipline that you may or may not have built up during your high school years. And for college golfers, that's the biggest thing that they struggle with that first year is really that time management going, making that jump from junior golf to college golf. So it's, there's a lot that goes into it, but I would say that's a real key component to what they can learn. And when it comes to our camps, we're simulating college golf. So that first day in a college golf experience camp, if it's a 2-day camp, you know, they probably traveled the night before. They're doing some things in the morning in regards to education seminars or practice sessions, et cetera. But then they're getting on the course for that practice round. And then they're turning around that next morning and they're playing a simulated college golf tournament round where they're putting up a number in front of these coaches, but also they're playing with the coaches. So it simulates it. The only difference is in the majority of college golf tournaments, you're playing 36 the first day and 18 the second day. Where at our camp, you know, they're playing 18-hole practice round and turning right around and playing 18 the next day. So there's very little turnaround and your time management has to be spot on. And so there are some similarities between college golf and what they're learning at our camps and the experience that they're getting.
Seems like there's a difference. There's a spectrum of people who come into this process a little bit differently. Whether you're someone who's been thinking about becoming a collegiate golfer since you were 8, 10, 12 years old, and you've been playing AJGA and that style of kind of elite level junior golf, or maybe you're a player who's kind of come into the game later or has come into their own later and has figured out how to play better, how to score better on their college team or high school team. Sophomore, junior year, they're coming into it late in the process and really realizing maybe they want to extend their competitive career with their academic career at the same time. How do camps meet both of those types of players that are maybe at the different stages of their journey, but also helping them in the same way at the same time?
As college coaches say, it's never too late to get the process started. But the key is you have to know what that process is. So whether you're a parent and a player going to one of these camps at 11, 12, 13 years old, or you're coming at 17 or 18, the key is that you get that education on college golf and what the recruiting process is like and the intricacies of what that means. That's the key to this, is that everyone becomes educated on how to go through the process and what you need to do, when you need to do it, and how you need to do it. And so these camps, whether you're a freshman and sophomore kind of getting a jump on the recruiting process for yourself, and you've got, you know, 10 to 12 programs that you've got in mind, and you may or may not be on a coach's radar, but you want to get in front of them to see if you've got a personality fit, these camps are great for that, right? It provides an opportunity for players and coaches to interact even prior to the June 15th deadline. So it doesn't matter whether you are before or after that June 15th deadline, coaches and players can interact at a camp, in a camp setting. But it's also for the late bloomers. If you're a late bloomer and you want to get on coach's radar and you want to get within that coach's network, That's a fabulous way. This is a fabulous way to do that because you're going to hear it just as you mentioned, Ryan. You're going to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. This is straight from the coaches. And as we've seen, I mean, we don't make any guarantees. We're providing the platform to help everyone get what they want out of these camps. But we've seen it many times where coaches will say, "Hey, this is obviously way after the camp, but they're like, "Hey, my class is full," or "I'm not really interested, but I think you're a great player and you're a great person, and we get along with your parents and we enjoyed meeting them." This is kind of where we see your fit to be. And there may be an opportunity for us to call those other coaches for you. So it's really part of the game that you need to play and that you need to be in that coaching network, unless you really are the best of the best. And if you are the best of the best, that's great because you're going to get a ton of calls on June 15th. But how do you know who you're going to play for? How do you know who you're going to say yes to? If you don't experience these coaches, if you don't get a sense of who they are, how are you going to make that call? So with something as big now with where college golf has gone, you've got the Masters involved now. You've got PGA Tour you've got direct connection to the PGA Tour. You want to be sure that you've got the right program and the right fit. If you do, it's going to make your life significantly easier. And you've got to spend some time in getting to that place.
And regardless of whether you choose to become or attempt to become a professional golfer thereafter, or this is kind of the end of your high level competitive experience, as a student, as a person developing into an adult, you want to just have the best 4 or 5 years that you can. At the end of the day, you want your college experience to be as fruitful and as wonderful as it possibly can be. And it starts with being in the right place with the right people.
Yeah, I mean, I played college golf at Emory in Atlanta, D3 golf, and it was by far the right place for me academically as well as athletically. And the college is supposed to be the best 4 years of your life. Now, obviously, there are players that are coming out early, and they aspire to, and they want to be on the tour, and they want to, go pro, and that's great, that's fantastic. But even then, you still need to be at the right program that's going to be able to, cultivate your passion and cultivate your talent. And be in a place that will give you the best opportunity to do that, or the best opportunity to excel over your 4 years, whether it's D1, D2, D3, NAIA, it really doesn't matter. So I hear what you're saying.
Want to dial in specifically on the upcoming top 100 showcase camps that you have. You have four throughout the remainder of the year. You have two in Atlanta, November 11th and 12th. And then you have separate camps in the Phoenix area, December 2nd and 3rd, and 16th and 17th. The lineups for the coaches that are going to be at these camps is pretty amazing. I mean, for someone who gets to watch a fair amount of college golf and see a fair amount of college golf news, the names that you have coming to these camps, not only is it a wide variety of different types of schools from different parts of the country, but the names are big. I mean, Mike Small, Jerry Haas, you can go down the line of different coach after coach after coach. What drives them to participate in the camps? And what are they trying to get out of the experience from these participants?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different reasons why they're coming to the camps. First of all, I think that they believe in our platform and what we're doing for players, parents, and for coaches alike. So I think that that's, fabulous from where we sit. And it's just a testament to what our team has done and the 200 plus coaches that we've worked with. So that's awesome, right? Number two, they're there to learn from each other. I mean, when you get such high level coaches in one place, it really doesn't happen very often. I mean, if you think about it, that is really happening at the NCAA championships and then maybe the US junior amateur. So that's really the best times that those happen. And so in this case, when you're thinking about it as if you're a player or a parent, there are very few opportunities that you get to be in front of that many coaches, this many great coaches. And it doesn't matter whether you're a top 100 player or you want to up your game and learn from the best. It really doesn't matter because you're going to get experience and coaching from the best of the best. And then, the third reason that these coaches are coming is there's opportunities to potentially see players. I mean, we had an Instagram Live with JC Deacon, the national champion from last year at Florida. I mean, JC flat out said, "Look, when I went to the top 100, the first one in December of 2022, I put five to seven guys on my radar that I didn't know existed." There's only a limited recruiting budget. And these coaches cannot be everywhere at one time. Sometimes these players have to go to where the coaches are. When you go to an AJGA tournament or you go to a high-level regional tour like the Southern California PGA Toyota Tour Cup, you're not guaranteed to be in front of coaches. Yeah, they may look at the scores, but you're not guaranteed to be watched. But if you go to these camps, you are guaranteed interaction and engagement with coaches. And there's a big difference in the end for coaches and for players when it comes to getting to that next level.
And I don't think that that can be underscored enough how rare of an opportunity is to be able to get in front of this kind of lineup of coaches, a double digit number of coaches at each camp who have the kind of experience, player development, everything that comes to their profession, all in one place, all at one time over a couple of days.
Yeah, it's when we came up with the concept originally, I was told that the top players won't go to camps. It's just not in their DNA. And as we talked about earlier, right? Tournaments in the past have been the only pathway. Now, camps are complementary to tournaments because you'll never replace tournaments. You'll never replace the aptitude, the ranking, the merit. You'll never replace that. But there is so much more to it. Tournaments are not the end all be all when it comes to playing college golf or to finding the right fit in college golf and that coach, finding you, if they are not the end all be all. So when we did our first camp, we had 72 boys out there. We had 50 plus in the top 150 of their class. That wasn't the end all be all, but they were starting to see that if we brought these kinds of coaches together, that there was demand for that. And the coaches told us that. They said, hey, look, if you get enough of us together, this could really move the needle. And so it's a great opportunity for all parties involved, no matter whether you're, like I said, no matter whether you think you can play for these guys, you're up and comer, you're a late bloomer, everyone's going to learn something at these camps. And the experience is invaluable. You're going to learn things, whether it's about college golf, the recruiting process, course management, the little conversations that you have with coaches walking up and down the fairways and tee to green, et cetera. There's so many things that will be bestowed upon you that you don't realize during your process and during your time as a junior golfer. It's invaluable.
With all that in mind, Josh, can you tell people who are interested after having heard this conversation to learn more about either these top 100 camps or the other variety of CGX camps where they can find that information?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just go to our website. It's College Golf and the letter X, so collegegolfx.com. Have all the information there. We've been really fortunate to have some great partners in these camps, and Adidas is the presenting sponsor of the top 100 camps, and we just brought on Clipped, which is this really cool game improvement technology and data company that now there's a technology partner to them. So there's far and away value at these camps above and beyond just being there. But there's a ton of information there on the coaches, on the schedules. And what also really is unique, I'm not sure if you saw this, Ryan, but the AJGA is involved in the November camps. So the AJGA is going to host dinner for all of us on Saturday night. They're going to give tours of their headquarters. And I think they're giving a little gift to the kids as well. So it's nice to see that complementary pathway come together. So it's really exciting for everyone involved.
Well, Josh, thank you for hopping on with us to talk us through it all. And we'll do this again soon.
Thanks, Ryan. Talk soon.
Thanks to Josh for being on the show this week. I appreciate it. It's always great to talk with him. He's just really, really knowledgeable about this stuff. And it's cool to see CGX taking off. So check him out, College Golf Experience. You can find out about their top 100 camps that are coming up in the next couple of months. That's going to do it for us this week on the show. Thanks so much for spending some time with us each and every week. Really appreciate it. Been doing the show 20 years. And it's still really cool to have these conversations with you. Check us out on our website, golfnewsnet.com. You find out more about Golf Newsnet Radio there as well. You can find Golf Newsnet Radio on iHeart and TuneIn, depending on where you're from. If you're outside the United States and Canada and part of Australia, you're going to use TuneIn. You have both options if you are in those countries or in those places. We'll be back with another show next week. We'll talk about some of the drama in golf, some of the news, some of the analysis that we'll do. And we'll probably do this up through Thanksgiving. And then we're going to go ahead and wrap it up for the year. We'll take about 6 weeks off. We'll come back in January ready to talk about the 2024 year. But we've still got about a month to go this year, so we've got lots to talk about in the month ahead. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.